from the vault. High atop the pastoral center of the Diocese of Camden, you're listening to Talking Catholic.
Hello, everybody. This is Pete Sanchez, staff writer for the Star Herald newspaper of the Diocese of Camden, Catholic Star Herald newspaper. And with me, as always, Michael Walsh. Mike, hey. How are you?
I'm very well, Pete. How are you?
Doing well. You are listening to Talking Catholic. And how's your week been, Mike?
It's been good. We're definitely in the dog days of summer, as you can tell by my sweaty shirt when I went out for a walk around lunch today. But other than that, it's good. We're hitting those sort of not a lot going on couple of weeks as we venture into what you're about to talk about.
Yeah, and actually what I'm about to talk about coming up next week, August 10th, is the Diaconate Info meeting. Mike, have you ever thought about being a permanent deacon?
I have. I gave it a great deal of thought, and I still continue to this day to give it a great deal of thought. I met with Deacon Michael Carter about it one time, and I still think it's something that's probably in my future at some point.
Well, it might be interested you and other men who are between the ages of 30 and 55, could attend an info session on this at Our Lady of the Angels, 35 East Mechanic Street, Cape May Courthouse. That's August 10th at 7 p.m., so coming out for that. And then, actually, I'm very excited, Mike. We have the Wedding of the Sea coming up.
We do.
In Atlantic City.
One of my favorite events.
Yeah.
May actually be my favorite outdoor event within the diocese. No, that's not true. I like iRacing vacations a lot, too. It's a tie between those two.
Well, what if this Wedding of the Sea just blows you away? Then that'll be number one.
It'll be number one until iRace comes around, and that'll be my next
favorite. Well,
I can't pick. I want everything.
Me too. The Wedding of the Sea is a signature annual event of the Parish of St. Monica in Atlantic City. Bishop Dennis Sullivan will celebrate Mass. It's going to be Boardwalk Hall. That starts at noon, the Mass of the Assumption of Mary, with the Feast of the Assumption. And then 1:15 procession to the Surf War. It's neat. Mike, Bishop Sullivan and the mayor of Atlantic City will get into a boat into the surf and throw a wreath into the ocean. It's really a great time. And then after that, there's a festival at St. Michael's parking lot, 15 North Georgia Avenue. And the Boardwalk Hall is 20301 Boardwalk in Atlantic City. For more info, go to accatholic.org.
And, you know, I think we're really doing justice to the events and how we're describing it. It's thousands of Catholics coming out for this Mass. It's one of the biggest Masses in the diocese. And then this procession to the Surf. The nice thing about Atlantic City, as opposed to the procession that will happen in Wildwood, where it's a mile from the boardwalk to the water just because of the nature of the beach in Wildwood, it's a very short walk to the beach in Atlantic City from the boardwalk. However, there's 1,000 people coming out in this. It's just massive humanity coming out to see this very lovely ceremony that takes place where the bishop goes out and goes about, I don't know, 50 yards into the ocean with the mayor and throws out a ring to bless the ocean and so that the city and the ocean work together to provide for each other and take care of each other and the people that exist in the community around it. It's just a wonderful event. So if you get a chance to come out to it, it's really something to see. And I've never not enjoyed myself at one of these events, whether I was working for the diocese at the time or before I came to work with us.
It's really something. If people haven't done it, they have to do it at least once.
Yeah.
It's a nice time, nice Mass, nice festival. And you mentioned Wildwood, the Wedding of the Sea. Bishop Sullivan will be there the day before, August 14th, at the Wildwood Notre Dame de la Mer Parish, begin 4 p.m. with a nice, cool choir and orchestra, and the Mass will begin at 4:30. And as the next day, he's also going to do a procession to the beach with the Blessing of the Sea in Wildwood, Atlantic City, 14th and 15th.
That's right.
And then a few months, I can't believe we're already talking about
October. I know.
I don't even want to mention Christmas. I've seen too many Christmas things out already. But this is October. This is not December. October 11th, 2017, in Atlantic City. It's a 2017 Justice for All dinner. It's a really nice, the Catholic Charities does it every year, Mike. Mm-hmm. And it's really, this year they're going to honor Cardinal Tobin. In the Archdiocese of Newark,
right.
And he's going to be what they're calling the Justice in Action honoree. who was he's Catholic Charities South Jersey has recognized him as a proponent and protector, basically of those individuals who need, you know, most in need of protection, the marginalized, immigrants, refugees, and it's really such a nice. It's going to be a nice time. That's going to be, again, at Resorts Hotel and Casino in Atlantic City, and just it's Catholic Charities. It's going to benefit Catholic Charities, which works in the six southern counties of this diocese, and it's just a great every penny collected. It basically prevents evictions. You know, it creates stabilization for the families.
Yeah, the Catholic Charities in South Jersey really does a great job, and Cardinal Tobin is an excellent honoree this year. You know, as you know, from where he came from in Indianapolis and what he's been doing in Newark since he's come to into the state of New Jersey, he continues to be a good advocate for everything that Catholic Charities itself, particularly our Catholic Charities, strives to promote and protect in South Jersey: refugees, immigrants, the marginalized, the poor. So he's a perfect candidate for the honor. And we're really looking forward to it. It'll also be the first time we do this event at Atlantic City. Another opportunity to promote Atlantic City here.
Yeah.
But it'll be the first time it'll be a resort, so we're expecting it to be a really nice event. So I hope people will come out. It's always a good event, and I hope it continues to be a good event. I'm sure it will be, as a matter of fact. So we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, I think that's going to be I can't say anything more. It's a really nice, been going on for, I forget how many years this is.
I think it's the 14th year.
14th.
Yeah.
And if you want more info for that, CatholicCharitiesCamden.org/JFA2017.
Yes.
Those are the exciting, dynamic events coming up in the diocese.
But amongst those many things that we have coming up, we also have a couple of things coming up. One within about a month, or a little more than a month, and another one in beginning of the new year. Pilgrimages. We don't talk about pilgrimages much. We had, if you've read the Star Herald lately, you actually heard about two recent ones. Bishop Sullivan and Father Michael Romano did a pilgrimage to Lourdes, which they were both really blown away by. They both came back with great tales to tell. And then for those of you who were keeping track for the last little bit more than a month, we had two seminarians on a pilgrimage.
Yeah.
They did the entire Camino from France into Spain and had a really phenomenal time. I have to admit, I was quite jealous of them. It's nice to be 24 years old and be able to to head out for an entire summer to do that.
Don't sell yourself short, Mike.
I know.
Let's do it. We can do the Talking Catholic on the Camino. One of these years, bucket list.
One of these years. As soon as my son's out of the house, then we'll do the Camino together. so anyway, we wanted to bring in pilgrimages, and one of the people who, in the diocese, who has a great reputation for putting together fantastic pilgrimages is Father Robert Hughes, the Vicar General for the diocese, who is good enough to share some time with us today. Thank you for being here.
Very glad to be with you.
Oh, this is wonderful. So I guess the first question I have is, you know, for me, who never did a pilgrimage, it's just not something I was ever presented with as a young person, and mostly as a middle-aged person too. What is a pilgrimage? Like for a person who is interested in going on one, how would you describe a pilgrimage?
Okay. A pilgrimage can be anything. I mean, it's a journey with a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So it all depends. I mean, you know, making a trip to Washington to the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception can be a pilgrimage. Going to the Shrine of St. John Newman can be a pilgrimage. But most pilgrimages are multi-day events where you travel someplace at a farther distance, again, all for a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And the purposes can range depending on the person themselves. Often they're done as a sign of penance. So sometimes they're sacrificial in nature. Other times they're done for the purpose of making a petition. You know, someone wants an answer to a prayer for themselves or for a loved one or somebody else in need. And other times they're done simply out of devotion,
mm-hmm.
to express to God, you know, the love that the person has for him. You know,
so. Yeah. Well, you know, as a person who's been on many pilgrimages, how did you become interested in pilgrimages? What was the first pilgrimage you went on? Actually, when was the first long-distance, time-consuming pilgrimage you did?
The first trip that I ever did that I didn't realize it at the time was a pilgrimage, but it, in a sense it was in high school. When I was a senior in high school, back in 1981, we were allowed or permitted, the vice principal at the time, Sister Marian McCann, offered a European trip. And so it was the first experience I had of leaving the country and encountering, we went to Austria, Switzerland, and Germany. And so to visit the various churches and shrines in those countries opened my eyes to, you know, a reality that was far beyond what you experience here in southern New Jersey. And so that, you know, I would say gave me the impetus to want to do this in the future. But then I was blessed also to study in Rome. So having that as a base, it's a very frequent and easy thing to do to go to the various shrines in Europe. So I had that as an opportunity as well.
Yeah. And have you found that for most people in South Jersey, is it something that they're used to doing? Are there groups of people who do pilgrimages on a regular basis? Or is it sort of the kind of thing you might do once in your life, twice in your life?
I think for most people, it's something that they do once in their life. But then they think it's going to be once in their life. And once they have the experience of going to a shrine and having the opportunity to have mass and confession and the various prayer experiences and things like that, they often come back and long for it again, you know, to a different location. So somebody might start off by going on what they think is a trip to Rome, ends up being a pilgrimage to Rome. And when they get back, they decide, you know what, I want to go to the Holy Land, or I want to do the Camino, or I want to go to Lourdes, you know, and the various sites.
One of the most recent pilgrimages you went on was a Camino walk as well. Mm-hmm. Can you sort of explain what that was like for you?
Yeah, last September I had the opportunity to do a shortened version of the Camino. In order to get the Compostela, which is the certificate at the end that certifies that you made the Camino, you have to, if you're walking, you have to walk at least 100 miles, 120 kilometers, I think, must be 160 kilometers. And so we did a 10-day Camino that was the last 10 days that would lead you into Santiago de Compostela. So it was a great experience. You know, it was late September, early October, so the weather was magnificent, it wasn't the popular time of the year to do it because many people do it during the summertime, especially leading up to the Feast of St. James. So it was a little bit less crowded, which was nice, and it was a small group of us. There were 11 of us on this pilgrimage, but it was a beautiful experience. Every day was difficult because you're traversing terrain that you aren't used to, going up and down, you know, hills and valleys, and the footing isn't necessarily always sure, but all along the way, people wish each other buen camino, which means, you know, good Camino or good walk, and you make it. You support each other until you get there, which is an important thing.
You know, as I was reading the Camino walk of our two seminarians, I was really struck by the amount of that there were two elements of it that really seemed that would speak up very highly. One was the quiet times when they could just do the walk and sort of be in prayer and by themselves. And then there was the group times. In a pilgrimage like that, where there is, it's a longer pilgrimage, there's more time. Did you find that that those times of reflection were particularly powerful for you?
Yeah, I was the chaplain for this pilgrimage, so it was my responsibility to guide the pilgrims with their spirituality, so beginning with Mass and the Rosary and prayers, you know, at the onset for each day and along the way. But as it happens, everybody ends up at some point walking by themselves, just because everyone walks at a different pace. So, from our group, so the 11 of us, frequently we're not together. So sometimes you found yourself alone on the Camino path. Other times you were with people that you didn't know. And both were interesting. I mean, you're meeting people that you don't know, and fortunately most people speak English, but at least they can communicate to some extent. So learning about them and their reasons for doing the Camino and sharing your reasons for doing the Camino, it was a beautiful way of praying, in a sense. And then when you had the times by yourself, it was just an overwhelming sense of peace because of the beauty of the countryside and the consistency there, the cadence with which you walk, you know, becomes kind of the rhythm of prayer, in a sense. So So it was a beautiful experience.
It's wonderful. And what about the Camino is sort of a unique experience in the sense of that long walk that's a requirement of doing the Camino. For other pilgrimages, say, for instance, you have one coming up soon to Fatima in Lourdes. Mm-hmm. Like, what would that experience be like?
This will be my first time to Fatima, so I'm not quite sure how it will be in Fatima. But my sense of it is that, you know, in these kinds of pilgrimages, where it's a destination pilgrimage, you're trying to reach a particular shrine, there is a great deal of history and personality to each of the shrines. So learning about the three saints, there were two saints and one soon-to-be saint, associated with the story of Fatima is part of the experience, that you have to learn about them and what they experienced and then how that applies to us and to the world and our spirituality. And of course, it's all out of devotion and love for our Blessed Mother.
Yeah.
The same thing at Lourdes. When you make your way to Lourdes, you're reliving the story of Saint Bernadette and the experiences that she had in her own suffering and in revealing to us, you know, a different dimension of the Blessed Mother and the healing power of God. So they're different depending on where you're going, but because each shrine, as I said, I think the best way to say it is it has its own personality.
Yeah. You know, I often wonder, you know, each pilgrimage is a little different. So obviously this is a question would probably be more depending on the pilgrimage you go on. But for a novice pilgrim, just from a logistical standpoint, not even a spiritual standpoint, but a logistical standpoint, how should they prepare themselves to go on a pilgrimage like this? I mean, what clothes should they bring? What should they expect? I mean, seriously, things like that.
It does depend on the shrine, because obviously and the time of the year that you travel. The reality is the less you bring, the more comfortable you're going to be, mm-hmm. because you're not worried about impressing people or dressing up for dinner or anything like that. So comfortable walking shoes and comfortable clothing. The shrines, most of them require certain dress codes, so you have to be aware mm-hmm. of that before you go. Generally men are encouraged not to wear shorts. In the summertime, they are a little bit less, they enforce that less because mm-hmm. of the temperatures. But in general, men should be wearing pants. Women have to have their knees covered. Everybody has to have their shoulders covered. So, tank tops don't work and things like that.
Yeah.
The funny thing is many of the shrines provide you when you get there, if you aren't dressed appropriately, you can purchase for €1 paper clothing that you can put on. So a guy can put on paper pants or he can put on a paper shirt. And same thing with the women. Women have it a little bit easier because all they have to do is buy one of those large scarves that can become a shawl or it can become a skirt, depending on what they need. Or they buy two of them to cover their shoulders and their knees. Mm-hmm. And often they do. So it makes it very convenient because as soon as they're out of the shrine, they can be comfortable again if it's very warm temperatures.
And what,
I think preparing, the two things that have to be done preparing are to learn about the shrine and to pray about the purpose of your journey. But then secondly, all pilgrimages entail more walking than we normally do here. So, preparing by, taking walks and getting yourself physically ready is also important.
Yeah. Even the destination pilgrimages?
Yeah, because Europe, especially Europe, the Holy Land, buses can only accommodate you to a certain point, and then you have to walk from wherever the bus can leave you to the actual holy site. And with security issues now, that's becoming even more of a challenge because they want to keep buses and transportation at a greater distance to where people are gathering. Mm-hmm. So that means you have to walk a little bit farther than you used to have to walk.
Yeah.
So preparing to walk is important.
Okay.
But I think many of them can accommodate, if there's handicap circumstances. I mean, there are accommodations that are made, and most of the pilgrimage companies are attuned to that and very able to make the adjustment if they know in advance that somebody's going to need that.
Someone who is, for most of their young adult to adult life, has been on many, many pilgrimages, how has the effect of the pilgrimage, the being there of the pilgrimage, changed for you as a young person going on pilgrimage to now being a seasoned veteran of pilgrimages?
Right. I think it's like everything in our spiritual life, there are layers to it. So the first time you go to a shrine or to a place that you've never been, often you're overwhelmed by how it looks and the experience that you have. And then if you visit it again and again, then you see different things. So, you know, you walk into a pilgrimage shrine and the first thing you see is just the beauty of it. But then you notice the way in which it's structured or the way it's focused, and new things are seen every time you visit it. And I think the other thing that's beautiful about it is that you get to relive your first experience of the shrines by those who are seeing them for the first time. So you remember the awe with which you walked into St. Peter's Basilica.
Yeah.
When you see, you know, the faces, the chins drop as they walk in and the eyes get wide, you relive the experience of the first time that you visited that shrine.
Yeah.
And how does it work? We're talking about these shrines and these pilgrimages. Does the Catholic Church have a vetting process to, is there like a, so people, in terms of accepting them, like, how does it work?
In terms of designating something
exactly.
as a shrine?
Yeah.
Most of them arise out of tradition.
Yeah.
So for generations, people have visited the same spot. You know, the more recent places like Lourdes and Fatima, historic events took place, not in our lifetime, but in the lifetime of, of people not too distant from us. So those are easier to certify and to recognize. Other places are places that are noted by tradition. So St. Peter's would be an example of that. You know, the tradition of pilgrimage to Rome was because it was the place where Peter and Paul were martyred.
Yeah.
And the location of St. Peter's Basilica, they're pretty sure that it's the correct place over which St. Peter was buried because, like we do today, people leave a mark. And in the early centuries of the church, people would, scroll or graffiti into the wall where St. Peter was buried that they made this pilgrimage or they visited this site. And when they, in the 1960s, uncovered that graffiti wall, they realized that the likelihood that this is actually the burial place of St. Peter is pretty high.
Wow.
So some of it's by tradition. Some of it is by, by historic memory at the time that this becomes an important place of pilgrimage. The people that went there could certify that, like Canterbury in England was a huge place. The Canterbury Tales are recount that. They knew that St. Thomas Becket was martyred there at the cathedral in Canterbury. So people would go there because they knew that that was a place of martyrdom.
It's really pretty amazing in talking about all these things, what to wear, physically fit can be really... gets people out of their comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that's the whole, not the whole point, but I would think everything, especially in spiritual life, sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
You sacrifice your feet, I guess, in a way.
Right.
Or you say, are there ways, do you have any particular prayers or, because I've heard people walk, they say a rosary or,
sure.
Do you have a method, when you're going on these?
Whenever I go on a pilgrimage with a group, I usually prepare for them a journal. And they all laugh because they don't look through the journal until they get on the plane. And the very first prayer on the plane, it has an image of a plane. And then the prayer underneath of it is the act of contrition because you're on plane, so you have to get them started correctly.
Perfect.
So they all laugh. They're like, Father, do you think something's going to happen to this plane? I'm like, no, but we have to be sure just in case, but the, no, it all, again, depends on the shrine. Sometimes the pilgrimage can be scripturally based, especially in the Holy Land. Other times it would be, if it's Lourdes or Fatima or other Marian shrines, it would be more rosary based and prayers that are familiar to us that speak of the Blessed Virgin Mary. So,
Speaking of the Holy Land, that's your second pilgrimage coming up in
February
2018, right? So you've done that. How many times have you been to the Holy Land?
I think this will be my 10th or 11th time.
Holy. So then we'll say you're a veteran of that. Okay.
Yeah.
So how about for people who, obviously, I think most Catholics want to go to the Holy Land at some point, but obviously there's also a trepidation about going to the Holy Land because of the Middle East issues, the troubles. So from that perspective, what is it like for someone who has never been to the Holy Land before, really wants to go and might not be mentally prepared for what they're going to see?
Well, the first thing is we follow the directions of the State Department. So if a pilgrimage is organized to the Holy Land and the State Department determines for some reason that it's not safe to travel to Israel, then the trip would be suspended and refunded. So, people don't lose their money in that circumstance. You know, other than that, the reality is there's danger everywhere we go. So, you know, we have to be mindful of that. You know, you could be in Philadelphia and somebody could decide to commit a terrorist act and drive a car up onto the sidewalk.
Right.
My experience of the Holy Land has been that it's one of the safest places in the world. Israel actually is one of the safest places in the world. And the Israeli government does a tremendous job of making sure that those who are visiting their country are safe.
Mm-hmm.
You rarely hear of tourists or pilgrims being affected by anything in Israel. It's usually difficulties between the Israelis and the Palestinians, or Israelis and other Arabs. And, you know, so that has to do more with their political issues than they all realize that tourism and pilgrimages are the lifeblood of their economy. So both of them keep hands off in a sense. And but when you arrive in Tel Aviv, because that's the international airport for Israel, you almost feel like you're entering into a mall. It doesn't feel like even one of our airports when you arrive, because they have already done all the security. You do a double set of security in the United States before you leave. So you go through our TSA security, and then at the gate, you go through another round of security. Israel uses facial recognition and other technology to know who you are before you even get on the plane. And if they don't want you in their country, they will not allow you to get on the plane. So when you arrive in Tel Aviv, they already know everything about you. You walk to a kiosk, you put your passport through the kiosk, and then you receive a little card. They don't stamp your passport in Israel because an Israeli stamp can affect you when you visit other countries. So instead, they give you a little coupon. You use the coupon to go through a turnstile, and then you're in what looks like a mall. And you know, it's actually a little bit more difficult to get out of Israel than it is to get in. When you leave Israel, it's always interesting because they will ask a series of security questions, as they do at most airports. But they will then take the group leader. So I, as the group leader, have to go and be interviewed separately. And then they'll randomly select a few members of the pilgrimage party and ask them similar questions to make sure that we all say the same thing and that we were visiting the same places and that nobody was interacting with people that they shouldn't have been interacting with, you know. So it's a little harder to get out than it is to get in. But all through Israel, I mean, there's never been any concern whatsoever, you know, as on any of the pilgrimages that I've done.
Yeah.
And the pilgrimage companies are very sensitive to, if there's an issue on the northern border, you know, then they'll adjust the program so as to avoid that.
You know, I was looking at the itinerary for the trip in the Holy Land, and from February 15th to the 24th, 10 days, Tel Aviv, Nazareth, Cana, Jordan River, Mount Tabor, Bethlehem, Bethany, the Jordan Valley, Jericho, the Dead Sea, Jerusalem, Mount Zion, Emmaus. It is that's quite the jaunt over 10 days. Are there any areas of the Holy Land that you haven't been to yet that you'd like to go?
Not so much the Holy Land. I would like to go to Jordan, on the other side of the Jordan River. There are some sites that are important to Old Testament history as well as to the New Testament, but haven't been able to get across there yet. In Israel, I was fortunate enough back in 1987 as a seminarian to do a 3-week walking pilgrimage of the Holy Land.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, the priest who led the pilgrimage was our scripture professor from the university in Rome, a Dominican, and he charged us $1,000 a piece to go for 3 weeks. And everything was included, our airfare, all of our meals, all of our accommodations. We stayed at youth hostels. We ate cucumbers and hard-boiled eggs for breakfast. We ate pita bread for lunch and, pita bread for dinner. And so it was very Spartan. And we literally walked. And we walked around the Sea of Galilee. We walked from Jerusalem to Jericho. We walked to many other sites. And back then, you could still go to – the division wasn't as pronounced. So you could still go to Hebron, to the tomb of Abraham and the patriarchs. And you could go to the well, Jacob's well. Those places are now restricted because they are in Palestinian territory. The only Palestinian territory that you can go to currently on a pilgrimage, you could go as a private citizen, you could do that. But pilgrimage groups, they restrict you to going only to Bethlehem, And you know, part of the Jordan Valley is Palestinian territory as well. So,
well, the now
you have to remember too, though, Israel is only about the size of New Jersey. So when you think about doing a 10-day pilgrimage and you know traveling from one place to the other, you know, with the exception if you go from the far northwest to the far southeast, that would be the longest distance, and that would take you quite some time.
Yeah.
But in general, all of the sites, you know, Jesus walked these places, so they're not that far apart. And when you're going by coach, it's very easy. So,
you know, going back to the logistics question that I had earlier on, what is it like? Is it up in the morning, out on your way? I mean, is it that sort of regimented, almost military-like movement of moving around, or do things move a little more slowly?
That's where the sacrifice comes in. No, it is regimented for a variety of reasons. I mean, one, you are assigned a time for Mass each day. The Franciscans have custody of the Holy Land. So, you know, when a pilgrimage is scheduled, the pilgrim company or the person directing the pilgrimage has to contact the commissariat of the Franciscans in the Holy Land, and they will schedule, they tell you which churches you can visit at which times for Mass. So you have to keep that appointment. They only keep the appointment for 15 minutes. If you don't show up within 15 minutes, then they'll give it to the next group that's waiting. So you have to be mindful of the schedule. And you know how it is. If you didn't give people a definite time at which you have to depart, people would, you know, straggle in, and you would be 2 hours delayed in departing. So they're pretty strict about, you know, making sure you get your wake up call at the right time, breakfast is served, and then you're right on the bus on your way to the next site.
And for these the pilgrimages that you take place now, not necessarily the ones that were $1,000 when you
were
in 1987.
We got $200 back on that one too.
Oh, really?
After the 21 days, it was almost 21 days. When we got back to Rome, he gave us each $200 back because it only cost $800 per person.
That's even a better deal.
That was.
Yeah. All right. But for people who go now that might perhaps not want to sleep in hostels, what are the accommodations? Like, how is the food on a pilgrimage like this?
It depends, obviously, on the country that you're visiting. You know, the Holy Land is, because of kosher regulations in Israel, you know, even though we're not Jewish, we still have to follow the kosher regulations because the hotels are required to do so. So it actually is to our benefit because the food in Israel is all buffet style because, of course, they have to keep separate milks and cheeses for meats and things like that. So they actually keep it separate in two ways. One, by the fact that it's a buffet, but then secondly, in the morning you have dairy, but no meat. So there, you know, obviously there's no bacon in Israel, but you have dairy and no meat in the morning, and in the evening you have meat and no dairy. Mm-hmm. So if you want coffee with cream, you can't get it in the evening. You can only get cream in your coffee in the morning,
mm-hmm.
you know, for fear that somehow cream would somehow would spill onto your chicken or whatever you're eating. So so the food is easy because you get to pick what you would like. So they have been breakfast foods just like we have, cereals and pastries and all that kind of stuff and eggs and everything. And then at dinner time, it's always a variety of fishes and meats and salads and pita and hummus. And, you know, there's a ton of things to choose from. Wine is always included at dinner. And, you know, so that's the Holy Land. In other countries, it's the cuisine that's local to that region. So if you're in Italy, you're going to have pasta and meat and salads. If you're in Spain, you're going to have you know, the local foods there. And in France, you're going to have crepes and you know, the different foods that they have. So so it's very local. The food is always at pilgrimage places. It's always in abundance.
Yeah.
You know, because you have to keep nourished in order to sustain yourself for the spiritual journey, and the accommodations are, it again depends on the country, but in general they are very, very good accommodations. Every once in a while you'll hit a clunker hotel,
yeah.
But again, that's part of the sacrifice.
Now, thinking like again logistics, you were talking about, you know, making sure you were nourished, like you got a carbo load kind of before you walk or exercise. Do people bring like energy bars, like bars?
People pack all kinds of things. I mean, for the plane ride over, people, you know, pack all kinds of snacks and, you know, Ziploc bags filled with trail mix or you know, people bring candy, they bring gum, you know, all the different things that you think you might want to have while you're there.
Yeah.
Most of the stuff is likewise accessible, you know, available if you go to the grocery store there. And in many countries, I always tell people to visit the grocery store and we'll take them to the grocery store because you can get good souvenirs at a decent price at the grocery store. In Italy, there's no sense in buying the wooden spoon, you know, from the vendor on the street corner for €5 when you can get it at the local supermarket, the same spoon for 50 euro cents. And so we had one pilgrimage where one of the ladies was the home ec teacher at Cherry Hill High School, Cherry Hill East, I believe.
Wow.
And so we went to a grocery store next to our hotel in Florence. And when you walk through this grocery store, everything said 50% discount. So she, you know, filled her grocery cart with all these different items and everything. She got to the counter, and they rang it up, and there was no discount. And she said, "I don't understand." You know, she's speaking English, of course, and they're looking at her. But she says, "I don't understand why I'm not getting the discount." And the checker said, "Well, you don't have an Esse Lungo card." She goes, "Well, how do I get an Esse Lungo card?" So they sent her over to the customer service desk, and she started to fill out this application. But the application, of course, was all to, you know, local to Florence. And so when she argued with the woman that she wanted one of these cards, finally the woman got so frustrated, she just gave her the card. So she went back and used the card and got her 50% discount. And then everybody else used the card. So, you know, it was great. And to this day, she has the card, and it hangs on her tree as a Christmas ornament.
Oh, my gosh. And that's it's something I've heard. I haven't been to a different pilgrimage of World Youth Day. That
right.
Is mm-hmm. really, I have not experienced that yet. I'm actually covering it tonight, the info session for Panama in
right.
a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take place. But a cool tradition I've heard is this diocese, the youth will bring something like to exchange with. They'll bring like a
right.
pen or a cap or shirt and trade it with, say, whatever country,
right.
you know, Ireland, you know, Colombia, what. Can that happen too?
That happens. I mean, it's just like at the Olympics, people exchange different pins that are created for each country. That happens. I think it happens more with young people on pilgrimage than it does with adults on pilgrimage. But adults will, you know, meet people and trade things, just as well.
Have you been on World Youth Day?
I have been. I was to World Youth Day in Toronto.
What can you say about that experience? Very. Whenever I talk to somebody on World Youth Day, it can be very powerful.
World Youth Day experiences are tremendously powerful for those who participate in them, especially young people, because often it is a first trip for them or a first pilgrimage for them. Encountering a different culture and different people. They are very often the diocese commits to doing what they call days in the diocese beforehand. So like when we went to Toronto, we were instead sent. By Canada, the Canadian bishops organized it, and our pilgrimage went to Quebec City. So the kids all stayed with families in the region of Quebec City, and for 3 or 4 days experienced what it means to be a Canadian young Catholic, you know, in Quebec. We priests stayed at the local rectory. The parishes, they had undergone mergers up there, and they had a rectory that they used as a guest house. And so we were blessed to be able to stay at the rectory, but it was phenomenal. We arrived much, much later than we anticipated. And when we got there, the entire church was filled with young people and families and the priest from the parish, all to sing songs to us in French to greet us and welcome us. And then they took the kids home to their homes. And then we made our way to Toronto, where we were hosted by a parish. And we all had to sleep on the floor in the school. So the classrooms of the school were divided up. You know, the priests had one classroom. The boys had several classrooms. The girls had several classrooms. And you had to rough it for a couple of days. And then, of course, every World Youth Day has, as part of it, a walking day where you have to walk from wherever it is you're being hosted to the site where the Holy Father will celebrate Mass. And our walk was about 9 miles, I think, or so. And as you're doing that, you know, people are coming from all different directions, arriving at this big field, you know, where the World Youth Day Mass is going to take place. And then you stay, you know, you get there for the vigil, and then you stay overnight, and first thing in the morning, the Pope celebrates Mass. So it's a beautiful, beautiful experience. And there were over a million people in Toronto from all over the world. And, you know, so we're this group of American kids from Camden, and, you know, right next to us were kids from Peru and kids from Germany and kids from Asia. So it's a wonderful experience.
Yeah. In some ways, it can kind of maybe be like an entryway to Lourdes, to the Camino. You know, they do that, and
right.
then mm-hmm. if they're in high school or college, and then they want to do more
right.
on their own.
Right.
And this is just such a great thing that, you know, you're putting on these.
And I think for World Youth Day, the experience leads to deeper involvement in church and in, you know, their youth programs when they get home. And also it's proven that it gives rise to vocations, both to the priesthood and religious life. So it's a great experience for young people.
Yeah.
And the church.
We've talked a lot about the international pilgrimages, and we touched on it at the very beginning. You mentioned some of the local pilgrimages, mm-hmm. but let's talk about that a little bit more. Some people may not have the money to go on an international
sure.
pilgrimage, or may not have the time or something like that. What about people locally? What can we do? What can people who want to go on a pilgrimage might be more localized be able to do?
Right. Well, I mean, in the United States, obviously, we're beginning to have many of our faithful members canonized. So any place where there is a saint, that's the, you know, the tradition that you would pilgrimage to a location like that. So the North American Martyrs up in Orrisville, New York, or to... as I said, St. John Newman Shrine in Philadelphia, the St. Catherine Drexel Shrine, although that's going to be moved to the cathedral in Philadelphia eventually, to Washington, to the National Shrine, that's a pilgrimage destination. There are pilgrimage sites in Wisconsin and other parts of the country. But the thing is, as I said, it's to do it with intention. So, for example, a beautiful pilgrimage in this country is to go and to do the missions in California. You know, to start Mission San Diego and make your way up the coast to Mission San Francisco, you know, is a beautiful experience. You see how the faith grew, you know, all along the route in Wisconsin or in California. You know, the same thing to trace the history of St. Isaac Jogues and the missionaries that brought the faith to the center part of our country using the river system,
mm-hmm.
you know, is also can also be a beautiful thing. So it can be both a pilgrimage and, you know, a historical lesson and, you know, all these different things. Because, again, it's the purpose with which you make the journey that determines whether it's a pilgrimage.
Yeah.
If you're just going to Memphis to, you know, to experience barbecue, you know, that might not be a pilgrimage, you know. But if you intend, you know, as you're making that journey to
yeah.
stop along the way at various sites that are important to the life of the church, then it becomes a pilgrimage.
Yeah. Well, see, when you said Memphis, what about Graceland?
Many, many people make pilgrimage
yes,
to Graceland. Yeah. That's true. You're absolutely right. You know?
First thing, but I will say you're talking about the North American, you know, going to and more close. I've been blessed. A few years ago, my young adult community, we went to Emmitsburg, Maryland,
mm-hmm, right.
to the Shrine of St. Elizabeth Ann Stephen.
Exactly.
And it was really awesome. Last year, I got to go. I have family in Gettysburg,
mm-hmm.
and my cousin, who's also my goddaughter, 12 years old then, we went there, and we went to the Shrine Grotto of Lourdes, which is right next door. But you're talking about learning about these saints. It
mm-hmm.
was really great because I, with my friends, we didn't have a chance to go spend too much time in the center exploring Sedan's life. But with my goddaughter, it was just great learning about so much. For her, it was a good educational experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only about three hours away,
right.
three or four
mm-hmm.
hours to Emmitsburg. And it's a little closer to Washington, D.C. That's
right.
beautiful,
right.
that shrine there. Pilgrimage over here.
You know, Pete, I was going to ask you, as someone who's done some of the local pilgrimages, you know, can you sort of explain what the diocesan pilgrimage to the shrine is like?
Well, the diocesan pilgrimage
in D.C.
is, it happens every two, 3 years.
Every
2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we did it last year. It's going to be in 2018.
Yep, even years.
And,
October of even years.
Okay. Thank you, Father.
Yep.
And it's what's really neat. The diocese comes together. Kind of they have a... Every diocese seems to have a designated shrine trip.
Mm-hmm.
So they can come in. It's kind of their own. So the diocese will bring buses. People, you can probably... I usually go on a bus that's near close to me, Merchantville, last year
mm-hmm.
at St. Pete's. And so you go there. You go down early. It's a Saturday Saturday morning. And then somebody, Bishop or Father Hughes, last year, you greeted you were out there greeting mm-hmm. people as they came in, celebrating Mass in this beautiful, the beginning was the introduction. Then it was kind of touring the crypts, their different areas, just to pray.
The national shrines. Yeah.
National shrines, mm-hmm. yeah, and just kind of really just a nice experience to pray in front of, say, like the images of Our Lady of Częstochowa or Our Lady of Fatima, Our Lady of Guadalupe. And then it's cool, too, because you see the flavor of Camden.
Mm-hmm.
into D.C. because they have the procession of the parishes. Parishes will bring their banner down, come together. And there's also the rosary, which is really beautiful.
In multi-languages.
Filipino, Spanish, English.
Vietnamese.
And you see that multicultural. You just see powerful stuff.
What about the sense of community for you? I mean, because I haven't done one, going down that bus ride, being there with people, do you get a sense, you get a stronger sense of community spirituality?
I do. I went down and it was neat because I ran into some friends of mine actually from the same young adult group that I went to Emmitsburg with years ago. I ran into this guy who was like, wow, I didn't know you were going on this. So it was nice. We were able to catch up. And it was a nice drive down there and just to be with everybody. And, of course, with me, him and I and a few others, we kind of stuck together. Mm-hmm. So the four or five of us walking around, exploring together for the day. And then what's neat, too, is coming back on the bus, all the people that you're with who you didn't see, you kind of enjoy hearing from them what was their best part of it, mm-hmm. what was their favorite shrine. What about the procession of parishes? What about the homily that Bishop Sullivan said? What touched you? And it's really, I've been going on I've been on three or four trips to D.C. And I highly recommend it next year, October 2013. Mm-hmm. It's really going to be
2018.
I said 13.
You did. We're going back in time.
We're taking a DeLorean to 2018. Thank you, Mike.
Okay.
But
that's great. Well, yeah. Hopefully next year I'll be able to go. My wife and I were planning on flipping a coin to go last year, and the coin ended up on its side, and we couldn't go. So it was actually unfortunate. She was really looking forward to go. I was really looking forward to go. And then we had something come up, and we couldn't go. Neither one of us could go, so it was a bummer. And I love that basilica. We've talked a lot about the places you've traveled to, Father. We talked about things you'd like to do that you haven't had a chance to yet. What has been your favorite destination to go to amongst them all?
I think that my favorite destination is the one that I've gone to most frequently, and that's to the Holy Land. I mean, outside of Rome, having lived there, that's a different experience, but going to the Holy Land, I think, is the most rewarding and most spiritual, because you can imagine, as the stories of the scriptures come to life, in the sites that you visit, and recognizing it, most people are moved by two places in the Holy Land. The first place is a real place, and that's the Sea of Galilee, because so many of the stories of the scriptures took place there, and they can imagine that Jesus was walking right where they're walking. Nothing has changed. The water level is a little bit lower than it was, so Jesus probably walked a little bit further up the hill than we walk. But in reality, he walked he walked that area. So you can very much get the feeling that you are walking where Jesus walked. And then the second place is at the tomb of at the Holy Sepulchre. When you walk in, there's they call it the preparation stone. And so it's the place where Jesus' body was was laid and anointed before being placed in the tomb. And it's covered with, by tradition, in Eastern churches, they use oil that is scented with rose. So as soon as you walk into the Basilica of the Holy Sepulchre, which is a conglomeration of many little churches, you are confronted with the preparation stone and this overwhelming scent of rose. And most people immediately fall on their knees, touch the oil, touch things to the oil, and they have a very, very real sense that Jesus' body was laying here. Mm-hmm. So it's a very powerful experience for people.
Wow. Okay. Well, we are just about done our time. Thank you very much. Pete's gonna has a couple of questions for you. Nothing too scary. Still no math, right, Pete?
No math. One of these days, I do know you are president. You were president of Paul VI High School.
Correct.
That's a good segue, Mike, talking about math, because I was going to ask you. I could ask you your favorite subject, but I was thinking it's probably theology. So, did you have a favorite subject
in high school
or in school, like for education?
I would say in high school it was the sciences. Even in college, I went through 2 years at LaSalle University before entering the seminary. Okay. You know, as a pre-med major. So my mother was a biology teacher, and so we were raised in a household where scientific experiments happened, you know, all the time, especially in the refrigerator. I think that if I had any subjects that were my favorite, they would have been in the area of the sciences. But I love history too, so, you know, that would be also an important one. In seminary, you know, obviously theology is important, but the nice thing about the universities at which I studied in Rome is that the historical method of teaching theology was very much a part of the lessons. So, you know, especially I did a specialization in sacraments, and they were all taught from the historical perspective, how the history influenced the sacraments and how the sacraments influenced history. So
yeah, it's all connected, everything. And that's interesting biology. I remember a chemistry teacher one time, always of the sciences, he enjoyed making fireballs from one of those Poland Spring water coolers.
Mm-hmm.
So he did that a lot. I went to school in Philly, St. George Prep, but I know LaSalle. A lot of my friends went there. So the next question, being the summertime, are you working? I know summer reading. Do you have a book that you're reading now or that you would recommend to somebody?
I'm still finishing the book by James Martin called Jesus, which is all about the pilgrimage to the Holy Land. It's very interesting the way it's his experience of visiting the Holy Land for the first time, and enlightens people on the various locations and sites that are visited.
He's a really very good writer. I think I've read about a third of the Jesus book.
Yeah.
And most of his other anything that he writes is wonderful.
Just as someone who's been to the Holy Land a lot, how does that balance with the book? Like what you're reading in the book?
Oh no, he does a very nice job of really helping people to understand. He ties the scriptures together with the sites, and then also he loves to use humor to deepen the understanding of what was actually happening. So it's nice. He proposes things that are not in scripture to explain why Jesus would have done this or why this site was important and things like that. So.
Okay. Just to not surprised with him, recommending him because he's just so, he's a good conversational tone that's really relatable.
It's an easy read and it's very profitable especially if you have any interest in going to the Holy Land. Or even just knowing the scriptures better. So
maybe you can get a kickback from him or something.
Exactly.
Advertising this book. So, Father Martin, if you're listening, what's your address? So,
and your third question, sir?
Yes. What would you do? You have any advice or that you would give to, I guess, anybody, Mike and I, anybody on this spiritual journey, like just inspirational. Or the best advice you've received on just living the faith?
I think that, the reality is that I always forget which Christmas show it is, but it's the one with the abominable snowman,
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Is that the one where he's, put one foot in front of the other, I mean, the reality is now, he's speaking physically, you put one foot in front of the other and eventually you make it across the room or across whatever. But that's I think the biggest thing that hinders our spiritual growth is our choice not to move. Mm-hmm. God will come to us, but we have to show some sort of openness to having him come to us. And it's not even that he has to come to us. It's more that we have to be awakened to recognize that he's already there.
Yeah.
So I think that the biggest recommendation would be, do something, open the scriptures, read a passage, meditate on it, go out and do service or, help somebody, you know, not for any other reason, but to help somebody, you know, do something, you know, that will get it moving. And when it seems to be going backwards, because it does, the spiritual life is fits and starts of moving forward and backsliding, you know, that when you feel that it's backsliding for that moment, you know, you have to remember, I got to do it again. You got to start, you have to start again. And so it's our failure to start or our failure to move that I think is our biggest obstacle, but one that's easily overcome if we just do something small.
Yeah.
You know, one of my favorite passages in the scriptures is in the book of Revelation when Jesus says, "Behold, I stand at the door knocking. If you open the door, I will come in and sup with you, or I'll have dinner with you." And, you know, so he's already present. You know, he's standing there knocking on the door. We have to be awakened by the knock and actually open the door. And then, you know, to have him share your life is basically what he's saying, that if you open that door, I'll share life with you.
So many people, I mean, I myself included at times, can get so in my head that I don't hear that knock on the door. I'm
right.
Trying to do the best I can, but I don't hear the call of Jesus. I'm worried about other, you know, but...
And I think that's the hardest thing. I mean, I think one of the reasons pilgrimages are good, you know, is because it takes us out of the ordinary circumstances of our lives. And, you know, very often that includes, although it's getting easier to bring it with you, you know, the technology.
Yeah.
But even on pilgrimage, you're so busy that you forget you have your phone. And that gives you the silent time to allow that process to happen, whereby you do you know, wake up and realize that God is present and motivates you to open that door.
You know, that's something we didn't touch on, the power of silence and disconnectedness
mm-hmm.
in the pilgrimage.
Right.
We're going to have you back.
Okay.
Talk about that. Or, you know, talk about how these pilgrimages went.
Yeah, absolutely. And before the complaint department gets to us, that song comes from Santa Claus is Coming to Town.
Okay, Santa Claus is Coming to Town.
I had to look it up.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
The Twitterverse would be a...
Yeah, skew. I never remember which one it is. Yeah.
I love, we kind of talked about Christmas twice.
And I guess it's winter, not the Abominable Snowman. Just,
that's right.
It's Mr. Winter.
The Winter Wizard.
Right,
Winter Wizard.
Yeah.
Yeah, ask me about cartoons, and I'm right there.
Yeah.
Ask me about anything else, I'm no good. Well, thank you very much, Father, for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
For anyone interested in going on one of these pilgrimages, you can actually read more or find out more about both the Holy Land Pilgrimage, which is registration closed for that?
That's open, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
the right. Holy Land and the Fatima, is that one
closed? Fatima's closed.
Okay.
Yeah.
But
you still can go, we just can't go with this.
Right. But if you go to pilgrimages.com/Father Hughes, that's FRHUGHES, all one word, you can learn more about the upcoming pilgrimages that he'll be leading. And you do this with regularity, right? So
yep.
With,
mm-hmm.
I mean,
they're all planned out through 2020.
Oh, perfect.
So
you'll really learn more. Okay, folks. Well, thank you very much.
Thank
it was just
you.
Great.
Thank you, Father.
And Pete, good talking to you as well. We'll be banking a pair of podcasts tomorrow since I'll be taking a smidgen of vacation time soon.
How dare you.
I know. It's terrible. I need someone to force me on a pilgrimage so I get out of the office a little bit. But anyway, this has been great. Talk to everyone later and have a good week.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Father.
Thank you.